This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 3 days after Mexico's presidential election, there is no clear winner. Preliminary counts of Sunday's poll gave conservative Felipe Calderón a lead of about 400,000 votes, about 1%. His opponent, leftist candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador, cried foul. He claimed that millions of ballots were missing. Yesterday, the head of Mexico's Federal Electoral Institute said 2.6 million votes are not missing, but they were left out of the preliminary count because of what he called inconsistencies, poor handwriting, unusual marks on tally sheets. If a review of those uncounted votes holds, the head of the commission said, Calderón's lead would shrink to about 0.6%, about 257,000 votes. If you have questions about ballots, counts, recounts, and court challenges, or about what this election tells us about Mexican politics, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. And joining us first is Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR's Mexico correspondent, with us from NPR's bureau in Mexico City. Good to speak with you.
Hello.
This sounds like an awfully familiar story to Americans. Vote too close to call, demands for a recount. Any idea now when a winner will be declared?
Well, I'm going to take you through just briefly what's happening today and then what will be happening in the next few days.
Okay.
Right now, sealed ballot boxes are being checked at 300 district-level election headquarters all around the country. The boxes, I went to one such center today, they're being guarded by members of the Army. They're being taken up one by one into a room where election workers, observers, and members of the parties are. Now, they then compare the tallies compiled by the poll workers on Election Day to what the Election Institute has announced and also what the parties have as their tallies. Now, by law, individual ballots can only be recounted when the packages appear to have been tampered with or their tallies or are inconsistent in some way. Now, that is very crucial because Mexico's main leftist party, who is behind, some say, in the vote, says that they won't concede the presidential election unless there is a ballot-by-ballot recount of every single vote cast. Now, that is not taking into account the law, which says only if there's any kind of inconsistency can you open up a particular ballot box and then count the ballots one by one. Mm-hmm. Now, once that whole process has taken place, it's really not clear how long that's going to take. It could end today, it could end tomorrow, it could end on Saturday. It just depends on how many disputes there are. And having been there, I can tell you that the parties are fighting it out vote by vote. Every box seems to be is being contested by the leftist party. And then, of course, the right party, Felipe Calderón, is saying, we don't want that box open. So it's a very laborious process. But the IFE, and that's the Federal Election Institute, must announce a president-elect by Sunday.
By Sunday. And, And are there different rules? Again, one of the things we learned in 2000, all of the different rules in all the different states of this country, is it similar in Mexico or are the rules at least the same in all the Mexican states?
No, in fact, that's one of the great differences between Mexico and the United States. Here it is federal. There is one law for the entire country. There is one organization that you can appeal to, which is the IFE, the Federal Election Institute. And then what happens after this is if the political parties, which they've already said they have complaints, they will go to the Federal Election Tribunal. And that's a kind of Supreme Court type of organization, but it only arbitrates on electoral disputes. And that tribunal would not render its verdict until September the 6th. So we're looking at perhaps an entire summer, possibly, of no president being announced.
The Mexican system seems to at least allow for the possibility of this. The current president, Vicente Fox, doesn't leave office for quite some time yet.
That's exactly right. I mean, the new president is going to take office on December the 1st. So, the safeguards that they put in place are exactly that. They say, okay, the law stipulates every step of the way what has to happen if there are disputes, and then who's going to arbitrate those disputes. And it gives a lot of time for that to happen so that there's no kind of, rush to get an announcement out. But of course, the climate in Mexico at the moment is very, very difficult. And I think if you had an entire summer of uncertainty, it would be very, very problematic.
I suspect there may be a conspiracy theory or two that's running around.
Oh my goodness. This I think you get it in every place, and certainly you get it here in Mexico. Let's just not forget, this is a country with 71 years of one-party rule where elections were regularly rigged. And so people are, you know, very skeptical of the electoral process. In 1994, IFE was created exactly to alleviate those fields, to make the system more transparent. And this is its biggest test. So what we're seeing now is the leftist party and its candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, are saying that they will not accept, they've already said this, the tally hasn't finished yet, but they will not accept the tallies today unless there is a vote-by-vote recount of all the votes. So what's being set up here is a real confrontation and, I think, you know, a real political crisis. I mean, I think we're definitely, if not there, heading towards towards that. You know, they say that there were very grave inconsistencies in at least 50,000 polling places. Mm-hmm. They say that votes cast outnumbered ballots distributed by the officials, and they say that there was flat-out fraud.
All right, let's see if we can get a listener in on this conversation. We'll turn to Daniel. Daniel calling us from Castro Valley, is that right, in California?
That's correct.
Okay, go ahead.
How you doing, Neil?
Very well, thanks.
I'm hearing reports that there's discrepancies in the PRD states where there's a lot less votes for president than there are for Congress and senators, and then in the PAN states, there's a lot more votes for president than there are for congressmen and senators, with the biggest glaring example being Tabasco, where both the PRI candidate and the PRD candidate are native sons, and you'd expect they'd have, you know, a power base there, but there's a lot less votes for president there than there is for the Congress people.
Let me just explain. PRD is the Democratic Revolution Party. That's the party of Andrés Manuel López Obrador. PAN is the party, the conservative party of Felipe Calderón. Lourdes, go ahead.
Yeah, I know. There's too many acronyms in this election, for sure. It's hard to do stories about it. That's right. I mean, that's certainly what the left party is alleging. They say that in places like Tabasco, I think it was 8-1 in favor of López Obrador. They say that should be much, much higher. It's a state with a firm, you know, PRD or leftist party base. Andrés Manuel López Obrador is from there. I can just tell you right now, there's just been a flash from Reuters, and they say that Andrés Manuel López Obrador is leading the recount with 36.6% of polling stations reporting, and that's from the Election Institute. So, you know, this is going down to the wire. I mean, you know, there's urgence going out every single second saying this guy's leading, the other one's leading, one's crying fraud, the other one's saying, listen, this Election Institute has been put in place. No one, you know, people trust it. It's not partisan in any single way, and we have to trust what's already been put out there. So it's a real fight.
Daniel, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. John Womack Jr., the Robert Woods Bliss Professor of Latin American History and Economics at Harvard, an expert on modern Mexican history. He's with us from a studio on the Harvard campus. Nice of you to be with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Professor Womack, as Lourdes Garcia Navarro reminded us, 71 years of one-party rule. Well, I guess this is what you get for having contested elections.
Well, I would contest that it was 71 years of one-party rule. In fact, Mexican politics has never really been a function of normal elections. If you go back into the 1920s before the grandfather of the regime that has just sort of collapsed over the last few years appeared. They had extremely contested elections then. The votes were all rigged. The problem was that they actually – pieces of the army would then begin to fight each other over the elections. Before that, you had 10 years of violence summed up as the Mexican Revolution. Before that, you had 30-odd years of a regime that where the candidates were all handpicked out of the through serious internal negotiations. So Mexican politics has never happened until very recently out in the open. These divisions that we now see, and they're very intense, are to some extent only aggravated forms of the divisions that used to happen inside and behind the scenes. They took as much intense, painful negotiation behind the scenes as they now obviously take out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this in some ways, what's new about it is that it is out in the open. But the contested quality of it goes back to Mexico's entire life as a republic.
Let's get another caller in on this conversation. Travis calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes, in recent years, we've seen socialist governments take place in Spain, Bolivia, Brazil, Venezuela, and Chile. And I'd like to ask, with Obrador at least doing this well, I mean, he's very close, if there's some sort of socialist wave going on, that perhaps in some indirect way Bush is firing up these socialists to get out and vote. And the second comment, actually, well, I had a
why don't we try one at a time, all right?
Okay.
John Womack, why don't you try that one?
I don't think that's true. I think Bush has fired up a lot of people in Latin America as elsewhere in the world. But I don't think that's what's leading to these votes. It's mostly the failure of the wave of a bunch of neoliberal policies over the last 10, 15 years in Latin America that has led to reactions from the left. Each of those countries is very different. Venezuela is nothing like Chile, Brazil, and Mexico. They're all very, very different. I don't think that, and to call them all socialist is, I think, also a confusing.
Well, let me ask Lourdes Garcia Navarro, was George Bush a factor in this election? Was he mentioned in the campaigns?
Not at all. I mean, I think the professor is exactly right. Every single country is different. All politics are local. We can't really forget that. And you know, every country has its own situation. I think what we're seeing here certainly is after the lid was taken off, after, you know, the PRI basically collapsed in 2000 with the election of President Vicente Fox, you know, these divisions have now come to the surface, and they've been given a voice by the parties. And I think, you know, When you see in Latin America, you know, there are problems with stagnant growth. There are problems with poverty. There are problems, you know, with people being disenfranchised. You know, that then, you know, when candidates tap into that, that gives them mm-hmm. A lot of power at the ballot box.
Travis, thanks for the call.
Well, it's over.
We're talking with John Womack, who's a professor at Harvard University, a Mexico specialist there, and with Lourdes Garcia Navarro, a Mexican correspondent for National Public Radio. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email question from Gwen in St. Paul, Minnesota. What are the worst-case scenarios if a winner is not accepted by both sides? What are the odds that there might be armed rebellion or a coup by either side? And Lourdes Garcia Navarro, I think the leftist candidate, Mr. Lopez Obrador, said that the stability of the country is at issue here.
Well, what they said today was that you know, that they weren't going to accept the results unless there was a ballot by ballot recount, and that they said they were going to take this to an international tribunal as a last resort if indeed their demands were not taken seriously. I think there is a fear, certainly, of armed, protesters coming out into the street. You know, a lot of instability, and that is certainly a fear. I don't think that there is necessarily, danger of a coup, mm-hmm. that the army would get involved. I mean, we don't really have a long, you know, that I don't think that's very likely at all.
Professor Womack, what do you think? Is stability an issue?
It is. I think not so much immediately. I think everybody involved, and there are numerous very powerful politicians on all three sides. I think they will probably manage to keep this under control for as long as it takes to get some sort of resolution. I think in the long run, though, that is to say over the next 3 or 4 years, that there really is, that's what's remarkable about this is the intensity of the division in public. The left and the right in this case really seem to be absolutely determined. And I think the politicians behind the scenes are much more realistic. But the more public the demand is on either side, the more difficult it is to negotiate. And the left is itself a more of a coalition of political forces than the right. The right isn't entirely unified, but they, I think, are now the solidest bloc or single political force in the country. And they're not going to go away even if they lose the presidential election. They are very solidly organized and more broadly so across the country now than they've been. The left, is, if it wins or loses the presidential election, is going to have its own internal difficulties. So the country is in for, I think, several years of serious, angry conflict at a pretty local level. And this is something, I think, that is unprecedented in the country's history for decades, many decades.
And let me ask you, Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, regarding what the professor just said, there were congressional elections in Mexico as well, and it's clear whoever emerges as president is going to have to work with the other side.
Yeah, I mean, I have to totally agree with that. It's a very, very divided country. People are very angry. And now what's being set up is that somehow people are going to feel that the elections didn't represent them, that it, that they were cheated out of their vote, is what I think is being set up at this particular point in time. And I think that will resonate for many years to come here. You're right, the Congress is very divided, and whoever comes in will not have a mandate. And I think that that is something that whoever becomes president will have to deal with. Let's just not forget that the current president, Vicente Fox, also dealt with a divided Congress, and that was one of the reasons people said that he was not able to make many of the reforms that he had wanted to make. And I think whoever becomes the next president will not only have to deal with a divided Congress, but a divided people and the legacy of this contested election.
All right. Stay with us both, if you will. We have a couple of more questions we want to get to after the break as we continue to talk about the deadlock in Mexico's presidential election. We're also going to be talking about American politics. Political junkie Ken Rudin will be joining us. So if you have questions about the senatorial race in Connecticut, the standoff in New Jersey, or about continuing battles over immigration, the 2006 midterm elections, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Cunningham. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're wrapping up our conversation of the deadlock in Mexico's presidential election. Our guests are Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, a Mexico correspondent for NPR News, and John Womack Jr., Robert Woods Bliss Professor of Latin American History and Economics at Harvard University. And let's get another caller in. This is Michael. Michael calling from Los Angeles.
Yes, I am interested in the question whether or not, if Calderon were to be confirmed, although I just heard from you that Reuters is now saying López Obrador is ahead, if I heard that correctly.
Kind of depends where they're counting, but that's what
they're
saying.
Exactly.
At any rate, what was that supposed to be, a national figure or a local figure?
We don't know.
It's 36% of polling stations now. I mean, I just wanted to say that just to show that this is a very close and contested vote, not to by any way, shape, or form endorse López Obrador's win. It's very early days in the process.
Okay. Well, since let's say Calderon were confirmed, since the PRI at least nominally is on the left, and so is the PRD, and López Obrador originally was with the PRD, I mean the PRI. Is there a likelihood that the PRI and the PRD would cooperate on at least de facto level and make it impossible for Calderon to govern? And as a footnote to that, you hear all about the presidential vote, and I have only once on Channel 52 from Mexico City heard a breakdown of the congressional vote, which at that time was 29-29. 27 PRD and 21 PRI. Is there a possibility of that kind of cooperation between PRI and PRD? And where do the three parties stand now on their congressional
tally,
representatives elected?
Yeah, Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, why don't you go first on that?
Yeah, I'm just looking at the latest figures, and I'm glad I had them to hand, actually. I'm seeing PAN with 33, PRD with 29, and PRI with something less than that. But again, I'm I would have to double check those what the mm-hmm. latest figures are. But basically, the PAN looks like it's going to have the majority, but not an absolute majority. Followed by the PRD, closely followed, and then the PRI. This is one of the big stories, really, of this election, which of course has not been told yet fully because of what's happening. But that the PRI, the party that was in power for 71 years, really did not do well at all, and their candidate Roberto Madrazo got about 20% of the vote, and that really is going to change things here. Now, whether or not the PRI and the PRD are going to make an alliance, perhaps parts of them will cooperate on certain things. It remains to be seen. I mean, there have been rumblings of that already.
Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, we know you've got extra work to do. There's this other program on later today. We're going to let you go. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
But I wanted to ask Professor Womack, before we let him go, if this could be part of the difficulty you'd mentioned earlier about the left having difficulty splits on its side.
Yes. Either of you mentioned earlier the conflicts that Fox faced in Congress. There will be tremendous conflicts in this Congress. The parties are more even as Ms. Garcia just mentioned, in Congress than they are on the presidential vote. And they're full of very savvy people who will be continually trying to undercut each other, making alliances against the president, but sometimes making an alliance with the president, whichever one he is, but back and forth. So I think it will be difficult beyond any living memory in Mexico to get coherent legislation passed. And it's going to have major effects on government policy. It will take extraordinary skills from whichever guy wins the presidency to get any kind of stability just in policy, much less to get legislation across.
Michael, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Okay. One question?
I think we've lost Michael. I hung on bottom. He had one more question, but we'll get to it next time we discuss it, and it looks like it's going to be dragging on for some time. John Womack, Jr., thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
John Womack, Jr., the Robert Woods Bliss Professor of Latin American History and Economics at Harvard University, and joined us from a studio on the campus at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts. When we come back, Political Junkie. Today, the lights are out in Atlantic City. Despite New Jersey Governor John Corzine's best efforts, the House Republicans pack their bags and head for the road to listen to what the country has to say about immigration. First stop, San Diego. And it's Wednesday, time again for our Political Junkie segment.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
But I'm the decider, and I decide what is best, and what's best is for Don Rumsfeld to remain as the Secretary of Defense.
And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House!
Yeah! It's your chance to talk politics with the junkie himself. Ken Rudin is with us. What political stories have you been watching? 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and the brains behind the always entertaining Political Junkie column at npr.org, is with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to see you, Ken.
Hi, Neil. Listening to that stuff about Mexico, thank God that kind of election problems don't happen here.
Good thing we've taken care of all of that stuff.
That's right.
Yes, indeed. Now, the craps tables are idle in the state of New Jersey today. Why can't the New Jersey state government agree on a budget?
Well, you think they should because you have a Democratic governor, John Corzine, and you have a Democratic legislature. But Corzine is pushing for a 1% increase in the sales tax from 6% to 7%. And Democrats in the legislature know what happened when the last Democratic governor tried to do that. Jim Florio, after he was elected, shortly after he was elected in 1989, proposed an increase in taxes. They went along with it, and they got wiped out in the midterm elections. And Christine Todd Whitman was elected 4 years later. So they're very cognizant about what happened, about the public's view about taxes in New Jersey. The property taxes are already among the highest in the country, and they think that going along with it could be political suicide.
Mm-hmm. Governor Corzine, of course, just recently elected. There is, though, a big race in New Jersey coming up this fall, and how might this, well, it seems like local, but again, all politics are local.
Well, if John Corzine has suddenly become the most unpopular person in New Jersey, and if Democrats are getting blamed for this, this could theoretically help the Republican candidate for the Senate, Thomas Kane Jr., the son of the former Republican governor. He's running for the Senate seat that Corzine gave up, and his Democratic opponent is Robert Menendez, who was appointed by Corzine after Corzine became governor. So if you can tie in Menendez with the unpopularity of Corzine and the potential of a tax increase, Republicans could have a possible winning candidate there.
And it seems that every week on Political Junkie, we somehow mention the contentious Democratic primary in the state of Connecticut. Joe Lieberman is still a Democrat. He reminds us that he was inspired by the words of President John F. Kennedy that he'll always be a Democrat, except maybe if he loses this primary.
Well, you know, it gets worse and worse because given the fact that Joe Lieberman was a Democratic nominee for vice president in 2000, he's been in the Senate for 18 years. But he has a very strong opponent in Ned Lamont. He's from Greenwich, Connecticut. He's a multimillionaire businessman. And he really opposes it. Basically, he's very unhappy with Lieberman's not only support for the war, support for his vote to authorize the president to go to war, but his criticism of his fellow Democrats on the war and about national defense and homeland security and things like that. And even though the last polls we saw show that Lieberman has a lead for the August 8th primary, there's a sense that everybody feels that the momentum is in Ned Lamont's favor. And so Joe Lieberman, a proud Democrat, a longtime Democrat who says if he wins, he will continue to vote with the Democrats. He has taken out the signatures to possibly run as an independent candidate in November if he loses the August 8th primary.
Mm-hmm. Well, joining us now is Mark Pazniakas, a reporter for the Hartford Courant. He's with us from his office in Hartford, Connecticut. Nice to speak with you.
Hello.
And how big a story is this in Connecticut?
As far as political stories, they really don't get any bigger, although I should hasten to add, we did nearly impeach a governor a year or two ago, so I should qualify that. But no, as far as campaign stories goes, this is as interesting as they get.
And is Ken Wright, is the political momentum perceived to be on Ned Lamont's side?
There is a perception that it is, and Senator Lieberman certainly added to that perception Monday when he announced he was going to start the petition process. He put a happy face on it. He said he's still a Democrat, but it's hard to make that kind of a move without it being seen as from a position of weakness.
And Ken Rudin, one of the things that does, as soon as he says, I'm going to get petitions so I can be on the ballot as an independent in case I lose the Democratic primary, a lot of other Democratic politicians have now had to respond and say what they would do about their longtime colleague and friend Joe Lieberman if it turns out he loses the Democratic primary.
And Hillary Clinton has started the ball rolling, basically, when she said that I will support the Democratic nominee. So that means that even if her good friend Joe Lieberman goes down to defeat on August 8th, she will back Ned Lamont. Now, others have not gone that far. Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, who's the chairman of the Democratic Senatorial Committee. Chris Dodd, who's a strong Lieberman supporter, the fellow Connecticut Democrat, neither of whom have said what they will do should Lamont win on August 8th.
We're talking with political junkie Ken Rudin and with Mark Pazniakas of the Hartford Courant. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Here's an email we got from Bob in Orinda, California. I suggest Senator Lieberman's announcement is aimed directly at the Democratic Party. While protesting his loyalty as a Democrat, the senator is clearly saying if he loses the primary, he will make sure the Republicans win his Senate seat by splitting the Democratic vote in November. Get your reaction to that, Mark?
It's really hard to make that prediction. The only public poll that we've had shows Lieberman winning quite handily in a three-way race. But the problem with that is that question was posed in a vacuum. In other words, how wounded would Lieberman be in a three-way race after having lost a primary?
Mm-hmm.
And these are the types of things that are so difficult to determine. The Republican candidate is a former state rep who has been out of office, state office, for 10 years. It does not appear he's going to be terribly well financed. But, you know, as you know, in a three-way race, anything can happen. Lowell Weicker won office twice in this state, first to the U.S. Senate and then as governor because he was in a three-way race. And there is an interesting parallel back to when Weicker won in 1970. Tom Dodd was the incumbent.
Dodd's father.
Chris Dodd's father, absolutely. He was a conservative Democrat. He was wounded because of his support for the war in Vietnam, and there was also a controversy in his office about personal use of some campaign.
And he was censured by the Senate.
Yes, he was. The difference was he did not seek the nomination. He went as an independent right from the get-go. There was an anti-war Democrat named Joe Duffy, who was the Democratic nominee. And then Weicker was the Republican. Weicker had been a congressman for one or two terms at the time. And Weicker snuck in with a little over a third of the vote.
And in the governor's time, he snuck in as the independent candidate. But
yes, he did.
So it's a complicated history. And really, though, doesn't this go to the heart of the Democratic Party's soul ringing in advance of this election?
That's how the Lamont campaign is billing itself, that this is a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. Lamont is first and foremost an anti-war candidate, but the broader theme of his campaign is that Senator Lieberman has lost his way as a Democrat, that he is supportive of George Bush not only on the war, but in opposing a filibuster for Samuel Alito, and that he has given cover to the president at different times, you know, by his statements. It's not so much his voting record. If you look at his voting record, Senator Lieberman still has, by and large, a mainstream Democratic voting record. His labor ratings are very good. In fact, he recently was endorsed by the AFL-CIO. But he has a habit of saying things at the right time or the wrong time from your point of view that resonate or anger people. You know, most recently was during the debate on a resolution to set a timetable for withdrawing from Iraq. It was expected that Senator Lieberman would oppose both those resolutions. It was not expected that Senator Lieberman would end up speaking, you know, essentially as a guest of the Republicans on their time.
Mm.
And there was great symbolism to that in this state to Democrats. And, of course, immediately after Senator Lieberman spoke, he was lauded by two Republicans, Senator Warner and Senator Santorum.
All right. Mark Pazniokas, thanks very much for being with us. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Mark Pazniokas, a reporter for the Hartford Courant, joining us from his office in the capital of Connecticut. And let's get a quick question in from Jeff. Jeff's calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Jeff, are you there?
Oh, yes. Hi.
Hi.
Yep. Great. I had a couple questions. First off, I wanted to get the opinion on the Senate race in Montana.
Montana.
The latest polls or any news on that?
And also,
the 3rd District in Kentucky is the first chance since 96, I think, we've had to unseat Ann Northup. So I was going to see any opinions, and I'll take my answer off the phone. Thanks.
Okay, Jeff, thanks for the call.
Well, quickly, in Montana, Conrad Burns has taken more money from convicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff than any member of Congress. John Tester is a Senate majority leader who's running against, he's a Democratic nominee against Burns. He is probably one of the best chances for a Democratic pickup in the Senate. Conrad Burns is thought to be in big trouble, even though he's a very effective campaign. But again, Tester may have the momentum there. In Kentucky's 3rd District, I kind of sense that Ann Northup is always on everybody's vulnerable list, but I'm not sure if the best Democrat is the nominee this time. And I think Ann Northup, even though she's always vulnerable, holds on for another term.
Ken Rudin, thanks very much, as always. Political junkie Ken Rudin with us here in Studio 3A, and you can read his Political Junkie column at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.